TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Observer staff writer Emily DePrang, who takes a personal look into religious worship at megachurches in her latest Observer story. There will be discussion about cup holders and communion lunchables, so be sure to stick around for that. But before we get theological, we've got a very important topic to discuss this week, property tax lending. Property tax loans are a financial product that is booming in Texas. In their six-month investigation into the world of property tax loans, writers Kaylin Barr and Charlotte Keith discovered that property tax lending is a virtually risk-free business, but for the most vulnerable homeowners, it can be a trap that leads to crippling debt and foreclosure. Here to discuss this is Charlotte Keith. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Robert Doggett, an attorney for Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, who was kind enough to join us while on vacation. Robert, thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
For starters, Charlotte, the story that you reported and wrote along with Kaylin Barr asserts that property tax lenders prey on the state's most vulnerable homeowners. Do you mind explaining how this business is predatory?
Sure. So property tax lenders make loans to people who are struggling to pay their property taxes. And then the borrower pays back the debt plus interest and fees that they might accumulate over the course of their payments. I guess the problems begin with the fact that almost anyone can take out one of these loans. The property acts as collateral for the loan. And so many lenders don't assess the borrower's ability to repay.
Right.
So even very low-income homeowners who really are in a bad financial situation could end up taking out a very high-interest loan.
Why is it that they're not totally concerned about whether somebody can pay it back or not?
Sure. So the property acts as collateral for the loan. And if it comes to the point where the lender can't pay back the loan, the property tax lender is first in line at foreclosure. So even if there's an existing mortgage on the property, they still get paid back first.
Can you tell us what the typical interest rate is on a property tax loan?
I think it's somewhere around 15% in the company that we looked at.
And which company is that?
That's Propel Financial Services, the largest property tax lender in Texas.
I was wondering if there's a particular area in Texas where property tax lending is a more common practice.
Sure. So it seems that the industry really flourishes in areas like the Rio Grande Valley, where there are a lot of people who struggle to pay their taxes. But it's really flourishing all over, especially in metropolitan areas like Dallas and Austin and Houston.
Robert, what do you have to say about property tax lending and them being first in line to get paid back?
Well, certainly being first in line to being paid back, in other words, having that super priority lien status, the status the government has when they choose to foreclose, is problematic when a private lender takes over that position, because obviously the government has checks and balances and political considerations before it decides to take advantage, if you will, of someone. Governments that do things like that typically have to respond and account for what they do, as opposed to very large financial institutions or whatnot, businesses. They don't really have anything that keeps them in check, and so consequently, the result is exactly what you would expect, which is loans being made at you know, exorbitant costs, and situations developed that should never exist. And that's what we have at Legal Aid when people come in to our offices and explain what happened to them. And it would have happened had the government in charge of the property tax situation. And it's essentially unfortunate. What's happened is the government has essentially relinquished its authority and decided to go let private industry take over a job that it should be doing itself, which is collecting property taxes from homeowners. And instead, it's taken an easy way out, which is let other people pay those and then allow these private lenders to step in their shoes without the checks and balances that they ordinarily would have.
You mentioned some situations that wouldn't happen under a government solution.
Sure. Routinely, situations happen where someone approaching 65, maybe 63 years old, maybe they've lived in the neighborhood for 25 or 30 years, maybe their neighborhood is starting to gentrify such that their property taxes are rising, and yet their income is still fixed, and they having a harder and harder time making those payments every year. And that's a situation that happens all across Texas in many areas. Well, the government, chances are push comes to shove, are not going to foreclose on that 63-year-old person living there. Chances are they're going to work and work and work to make sure and avoid having to take their house away. Whereas we get these situations where they have been persuaded and pressured by a tax lender to have their taxes paid off. The tax lender buys the delinquency list from the local authority and blankets the area with invitations, let's just say, to pay your property taxes and avoid foreclosure. And someone might not know the situation and be scared enough to go ahead and take out that property tax loan. And then when the person can't afford to pay, threaten them with foreclosure, whereas the government wouldn't do that. When you reach age 65, you're entitled to defer those taxes. And, you know, we rarely, if ever, have seen a government threaten to foreclose when they know the person is 65 or older, because they know that elderly person's entitled to defer and therefore avoid foreclosure. It doesn't avoid the taxes being owed, but it stops the penalties and it also prohibits the foreclosure itself. And so we see situations like this happen routinely.
This question goes to both of you. Why would somebody go through a property tax lender rather than go directly to a government solution?
Well, I guess it was the people that we've spoken to for the story, including, you know, borrowers who we didn't actually name in the story. A lot of people don't fully understand how the tax system works. And, you know, I think Keelan and I would both attest that it can get pretty complicated, trying to understand the system and the loans and all that kind of thing. And the advertising for these companies makes it look like a really good deal, and it makes it look very simple. And so even though when borrowers take out a loan, they sign a lot of forms which acknowledge certain conditions of the loan, you know, people don't always read or understand the fine print. And so it seems, from a kind of consumer standpoint at first, like a financial lifeline.
I see. Robert, anything to add?
Well, as Charlotte indicated, it's slick marketing is some of the reason. You know, I mean, think about it. The government doesn't do as good a job, if you will, threatening or pressuring or luring people into paying their property taxes, if you will. And some out there are very, very good at it and have utilized, you know, every conceivable method you can imagine to try to get people to do it on the private side. And the other reason for that is some tax collectors, taxing entities, don't offer payment plans or terms that are reasonable. So it's possible you have a borrower that is, or if you a homeowner that's very sophisticated, but has temporarily suffered a loss of income, and they're trying to work something out with the local taxing entity. The taxing entity is taking a hard line and offering a payment plan that's not, frankly, reasonable. And instead, rather than rolling the dice and hoping they won't be foreclosed on, they instead go to the private sector and are willing to go ahead and sign a paperwork that will put a lien on their house at an exorbitant interest rate and higher fees than they otherwise would pay. And so it's twofold, essentially. You've got the private industry with a clear financial interest into doing this. And then on the other side, you've got governmental entities that don't have an incentive necessarily to try to work it out with homeowners. They just as soon have the private people pay them off and they don't have to go to any trouble. And so you put those two together and it spells an industry that's worth billions of dollars over the years. And that's what we have today.
Charlotte, one of the things that really stuck out for me reading your story is that this service is offered only in Texas and Nevada. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And why is that?
The way that the industry developed in Texas was because of a particular provision in state law that was kind of a hangover from the 30s, which allows someone to pay off someone else's property taxes for them. And it was originally kind of intended for family members to pay off other family members' taxes. And then, I guess maybe kind of in the 90s, people started to realize that this could be a business opportunity, and it could be kind of turned into create this industry. And so Propel, in 2012, lobbied successfully to change the law in Nevada to give them the same lien priority they had in Texas, which is really crucial to the business's profitability. And so I think the industry is kind of still in early form in Nevada, but it could well take off there like it has here.
But one of the sections of your story talks about Propel trying to expand into Virginia, and Virginia seemed to not be interested. Can you explain that situation?
Yeah, Propel has been targeting a lot of other states for their expansion efforts. And Virginia, Arizona, Oregon, Missouri, Utah. And in so far, they've got quite a frosty reception in places apart from Nevada. Utah, I think it was really striking, even passed a law banning the business there, even though it didn't exist there. So it was kind of a preemptive action to make sure they couldn't expand there. And in the other states, it seems so far like their efforts haven't got that far, largely because of opposition from mortgage bankers. But, you know, it's still early days, and I think so far the company is pretty set on expanding more.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the people that you interviewed for this story. What can you tell us about the Acosta family?
So the Acosta family really is quite a heartbreaking example of what can happen when these loans go wrong. The Acostas live with their children and grandchild in Sullivan City near McAllen. And they lost their home and were evicted earlier this year. And now they live in a kind of rundown rental house just across the street from their old property. And the Acostas don't speak much English. And they really didn't understand entirely what they were signing away when they got the loan out. They made real efforts to repay despite a very difficult financial situation, but they found it hard to understand kind of what was going on and to communicate with the company. And so they ended up losing their house over a $20,000 loan, which they had made substantial inroads in paying back.
What does substantial inroads mean? How much are we talking about?
So at one point in 2010, they made a $9,000 lump sum payment. But I guess part of the difficulty with these loans is that you can make a big payment like that, which seems like it's going a long way to solving the problem. But over a long period of time, the interest adds up and then late fees add up. In the other case that we profile in the story, Maria Solorzano, her late fees and interest added up to almost as much as her original loan itself. And so that's something that people don't always factor in when they're making repayments.
Robert, is this case sounding familiar to you? Is this what your clients are dealing with?
Absolutely. Obviously, time value of money exists. And the question is an interest rate that is so high compared to possibly what you would see on the market for a typical mortgage, for example. It's a vast difference, plus all the fees and charges and everything else they can try to milk out of people. Remember this, that these tax lenders may say that they have a very low foreclosure rate, but they have such a high interest rate, they'd almost prefer to just keep lending as much money as they can because, again, in the end, they know they're going to get their money either directly from the homeowner or at the foreclosure sale or at a regular sale of a property when somebody goes to sell it to someone else. So This is extremely similar, I'd say. We'd see the same thing over and over and over again. And that's why this business wants to expand across the country, because it's very lucrative. And if something is not done and people are asleep at the switch in these other states, I'm afraid it will continue to expand.
Charlotte, real quick, we're almost out of time, but I was wondering if there have been any updates with the families that you featured in your story since you did your reporting.
Not really so far. Maria Solorzano is kind of still trying to decide how much to pursue getting her house back, or trying to recoup any of the money that she lost from using the equity. I mean, Acosta's are kind of in a similar situation. I think it's a very difficult choice for people in that situation. When do you kind of let it go and focus on making the best of what you have? And especially because, you know, fighting to try and get the house back or any of the money back is itself very expensive, because you have to hire a lawyer. And so in both cases, they've kind of struggled for a while to try and get something back. But really, when you get to the stage where you've been foreclosed on, because everything the borrowers do, the lenders do, is legal. They have all these legal rights under state law. It can be very difficult for borrowers who end up losing their home to get anything back.
Well, Charlotte and Robert, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks.
Thanks for covering it.
The story is A High Price to Pay. You can read it on TexasObserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Well, you've seen them, I've seen them. Driving down the highways of Texas, it's impossible not to notice them. The stadium-like structures known as megachurches. In her latest for The Observer, Emily DePrang takes a look at the megachurch phenomenon by diving headfirst into worship at Lakewood Church. Yep, the same one broadcast on TV, emceed by the uber-righteous Joel Osteen. Here to give us the details on her experience is Emily DePrang. Emily, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I don't suppose that most spiritual journeys really need much of an explanation, but I'm wondering if there was a catalyst behind your megachurch investigation.
I was raised very religious, and the Methodist Church is a very traditional church. I was very happy being in that church community, and I never did quite find another church I was comfortable with, and part of it is that I would visit churches with people that I loved, like my in-laws, and they all attended mega churches. They all, which, you know, that term, when researchers work on it, they usually designate it as churches with an average attendance of 2,000 people or more per weekend.
Right.
So really big churches. And there was just, and I really wanted to know. Basically, I went to church with, I had been thinking about mega churches and thinking about, you know, whether my problem was really just basic snobbery, or if it was just that I didn't like something that was different or something that was new. And I've been kind of poking this question a little bit, because I would go to church with my in-laws, you know, every holiday and some other days too. And then there was one time I went to church with them recently, not that long ago, and it was Baptism Sunday. Well, baptism in the Methodist Church means you've got little bitty babies and you put a little water in your hand,
right.
And the pastor, who's wearing a long robe, you know, walks the baby around, and everybody says, oh my God, cute baby. Okay. What it meant in this church was that they had like a wading pool out front, and people would put on, you know, T-shirts, baptism-themed T-shirts, and get dunked. And so the pastor was doing this between services in like board shorts and a T-shirt,
right?
And flip flops, right? Normal. You're standing in a pool. Why not? I mean, obviously, back in the day, they would stand in the river and dunk you, you know, wearing a suit. But whatever. But then we went into service, and he was a little late coming because he had just been in the pool, and he was wearing board shorts and flip flops.
Right.
And I was like, okay. Now, that's not to say that every megachurch, I mean, there's plenty of megachurches where the pastor wouldn't wear board shirts and flip-flops, but
sure.
It kind of just brought to my mind, like, okay, do I actually think there's anything wrong with the casual, pop, very technologically engaged megachurch phenomenon, like, what's my problem? And so I started to see if I could sort of take a sociological approach. I read a lot of research, and then I went to Lakewood and just tried to keep an open mind and pay attention.
All right, I have to ask before we get too far away, because I have never been to a megachurch, and so I have only experienced it through reading what you've written about them. Cup holders?
Yes.
What's up with that?
It's a place to hold your cup. See, this is the thing. The context is that one of the megachurches that I've attended several times has these stadium seats, and the armrests have cup holders. And the first time I saw it, I was like, are you kidding? You know, what is the difference between worshiping God and going to a movie at this point? What is the difference between laser paint Floyd and worshiping Jesus? Like, and then, you know, but that's a very easy question to ask, and it's very easy to be sort of snotty and facile about it. And the reality is that, you know, there's nothing holier about sitting on a wooden pew that hurts your butt.
Right.
There's not. You can't make a case for that.
Right.
What you can make a case for is the feeling, and obviously it's stupid to be prescriptive about it, to say, oh, well, you know, you are less holy than me because my chair hurts, you know. Because I don't bring drink in, and if I did, I couldn't put it somewhere safe. But, you know, that would be dumb. But that's the kind of thing that I reacted against, that I was like, church with cup holders, what? And so that was what I wanted to examine, is whether or not, you know, there was anything under that, or was that just my, you know, cane shaking, you kids get off my lawn with your newfangled screens and your big laser light shows.
But did you find that there was more of a spiritual experience, more of a moving experience by being in, I mean, room is not really the right word, but in a space with so many other people so intently focused on this? I mean, I would imagine that going to Lakewood Church has a vibe not unlike going to a really good rock concert.
I think it does, in that, you know, if I had been, you know, in the floor seats that were standing up and, you know, clapping over their head and very close to, could get sweat on yourself, you know, if Joel Osteen were capable of sweating, which I'm sure he's not. I'm sure that just like a rock show, like, you know, if you're in the nosebleed seats, then you have this kind of surreal, literal and figurative distance on it. But a lot of people around me were obviously really, really engaged. And, you know, one of the things that didn't make it into the story, but that it really mattered to me, was that I was sitting in front of this mom and her two sons, and she just, during prayer, she would just, you know, they were probably like 11 and 14. And during prayer, you know, she would just clasp their hands, and she would, you know, put her arms around them. And she, you know, and when it was time to tithe, she pulled out a $100 bill and handed it to her younger son to put in the basket as it went by. And it was actually a bucket. But, you know, one of the things that I had to respect, and I hope that I did, I think I did, I never forgot that this is incredibly, just life-savingly important, this church. It's crucially important, spiritually and emotionally sustaining for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of people. It's easy for Lakewood to be a punchline, and it's not for me. It's not my style of worship, and there was a lot that I found unsettling about it, but there's no denying that this is a meaningful and powerful spiritual space for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm going to share just one line from your story real quick about this. You write, Osteen and I are strangers, but his praise still felt tender and good, like having my hair stroked. I wondered how many people in the arena never hear words like that except here. I'd show up every week, too.
Exactly.
You know, that really struck out for me as being important.
Thanks.
Let's talk about Mr. Osteen just for a brief minute here while we still have some time. Going from your more traditional Methodist background, what was it like having him on stage with, you know, Christian rock bands and laser lights and stuff?
Well, what's interesting about Joel Osteen is that he's such a star that when he is talking, there's not a rock band and a laser light show. Like, when he comes out with his wife and he does a, you know, it's very much like a, I mean, when I first walked away from it and I hadn't processed it at all, but I walked away from it feeling super weird. I didn't know why, but after the service, it was a long, you know, hour and a half, and after the service, I just wandered around in the bookstore afterwards and looked at this, you know, line of more than 100 people waiting to shake his hand with the, you know, two off-duty police in uniform with guns standing on either side of him, you know, keeping an eye on the line. And it was just a surreal feeling. But I was just kind of cranky. I didn't know why. And my first impression was, you know, it was like a rock concert celebrating me, because so much of the language in the songs and in the sermon and in the prayers was all about how I'm super great and God really loves me and he's going to do great things in my life if I just believe, because my belief is the currency. The piece is supposed to be funny and it's supposed to be, you know, a little bit aloof, because, you know, a little separate from the subject, looking at it sociologically, but this stuff is incredibly personal for me. And it's the desire to understand and find what kind of church can still nourish my cynical grown-up self. I mean, that's very real for me.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
The piece is Gimme Shelter. You can read it on TexasObserver.org. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.